Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you're tuning in live or catching the podcast later, please stay with us for in-depth conversations with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Monday, the 7th of October. Coming up, the work visa points system to go live in days. Busa is worried about today's COSATU-led protest action, what the so-called sandwich generation is using their two-pot retirement system withdrawals for, and safety standards and driver training at one of the country's leading e-hailing systems. Now, Business Unity South Africa raising concerns about COSATU's planned nationwide protest today, calling it counterproductive to addressing the country's economic challenges. The protest, dubbed a National Day of Action, is aiming to highlight issues such as austerity, retrenchments, and the rising cost of living. While COSATU remains firm in its stance, Busa is arguing that these grievances should be addressed through dialogue rather than disruptive action. I'm in conversation now with the Chief Executive Officer Designate at Busa. Kulakani Mate, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. Before we get to your assessment of what has happened so far, your big issue today is the issuance of the strike certificate. What's the concern here?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and to the listeners of MoneyWeb. So, Jeremy, we have called for the reforms to Section 77 of the Labour Relations Act, which essentially deals with the protest action such as we are having today. Because what is happening is that there is no limit placed on when a certificate expires, a certificate that allows a trade union to go on strike. Today's protest action is essentially based on a certificate that was issued in 2020. Obviously under different economic conditions, but it continues to be used today. What that does is that it deprives all parties at NEDLAC, in particular, the private sector, the businesses, an opportunity to engage with those proposing strikes to assess whether the proposed strike ticks all the boxes such that it should be authorized. And so relying on a certificate that was issued many years ago under different conditions is not very helpful, and this is why we are calling for its reform.
And today's strike, does it tick those boxes that you'd like to be ticked?
Well, as far as we're concerned, it doesn't, because in particular, here we are talking about an economy that has serious weaknesses, has not recovered from the effects of COVID-19. Jobs are obviously that were lost then have not all been recovered, if you like. And so we're talking about a weak economy, and staging a strike in a weak economy is in fact just adding a salt to the wound rather than solving problems. And this is why we're saying that while the concerns are valid, but we don't think that the method used here is helpful at all.
But it really is symbolic. There's not a huge impact on the economy if it just lasts a day or two, surely?
Well, the thing is, any form of disruption in a weak economy such as ours is just not helpful at all. Yes, it is symbolic, but actually to the extent that there are workers who are not pitching up for work, we know and accept that, look, workers themselves are going to be impacted negatively here because they lose wages. And all of that does add to the pain that not only workers, but the rest of society, the economy, has to bear as a consequence of dealing with a matter that could be dealt with via and through dialogue by staging a protest action.
The sense one gets from Cassatu is that they're tired of dialogue, that that particular option is running out of steam.
I don't believe that there's any other way in which you can solve the intractable problems that such as ones that are facing the South African economy. We don't, from a business point of view, subscribe to the view that staging a protest action solves issues of unemployment and all the other challenges that we face.
What's your assessment so far of today's strike action?
Well, you know, we're located in Sandton, as you know, that we will receive COSATU when they deliver a memorandum. So we are here waiting for COSATU. We do not have a view of what's happening in other parts of the country other than the snippets that we're hearing. It doesn't sound like this action is very well supported. It sounds like work is going ahead in different parts, and so in a sense the impact is minimal, but I think symbolic as it is, we are concerned that there are some workers who may not have shown up.
The point that I'm making is that it's making very little difference at all. So do you need to be so critical of it?
So the bigger point we're making here is that whether it has a minimal or bigger impact, we do need to find solutions to the challenges facing this economy. And we just don't believe that staging a project action, whether it receives large support or limited support, we don't believe that it is a solution to the real challenges that COSATU has raised and challenges that we agree with.
Fair point. So what's your plan?
Well, you know, we are in NEDLAC all the time, ready and willing to engage with other social partners in NEDLAC. But as you know, Jeremy, some of the challenges in this economy have, for instance, been due to the failures in our network industries, etc. Many businesses that are exposed to the logistics sector would have reported reduced earnings just because of the challenges there. I'm using that as an example. So as a private sector, we're really stepping up to the plate because we believe in this economy and we want to be part of the solution. We're working with government to try and resolve problems there.
Are you working sufficiently with labor? You've just said to me you're ready and willing, but does that really cut it? Does business need to be a little bit more proactive in this respect?
I don't know that there is any more being more proactive than we have been. I mean, just last week, President Ramaphosa was launching phase two of our partnership. This is where we are putting shoulder to the wheel and saying, let us solve challenges. So we didn't wait for today's strike. Mm. This is a partnership that started last year and is beginning to show some positive results. And so from where we stand, business has been very proactive and will continue to do so.
But organized labor such as COSATU still feels that it's outside the tent.
I do not believe so, that they're outside the tent, because anything does involve workers at every level. I mean, all of the efforts to change and improve Eskom, for instance, and resolve energy could not have happened without the participation of the thousands of workers in Eskom. Similarly, the work we're doing in transport and logistics, working with Transnet, just cannot happen without the participation of labor. So labor is very much part of the solution here, and we believe that we should hold hands, find solutions, work together.
Appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed. Kulakani Mate is the Chief Executive Officer Designate at Business Unity South Africa.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
South Africa is on track to become the 10th largest solar market in the world this year. Get all the ins and outputs of our solar power revolution and what it means for your home, your business, and the future of our country. Listen to The Current, the definitive podcast on South Africa's energy transition, only on Investec Focus Radio SA. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Investec Bank Limited is a licensed FSP. T's and C's apply.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the Home Affairs Minister, Leon Schreiber, says signalling a shift away from past immigration policies that critics have labelled xenophobic is top of mind. And immediate changes, he said, are going to include a new points-based system for work visas that makes eligibility automatic if you have certain qualifications, and as well as the launch of a remote work visa, both of which he says will be finalised in a matter of days. He joins me on the programme now. Minister, then, can you provide more details on how the system is going to work, how it's going to function, and particularly what qualifications will automatically make people eligible?
Yes, so the timeline is really very, very close now. As we speak, I'm looking at some of the final revisions on the regulations. I must say we've gone through a very thorough and extensive process to ensure that this is a very user-friendly system and that it ensures both that we increase transparency and fight corruption that we have in the case of visa processing, but also that it is user-friendly and actually amounts to a very serious economic reform, because it will enable companies to attract the skills that we need in this economy. So it really, I believe, is a matter of days. And in terms of details, you know, it's going to create a very easily understandable point system that is also going to be transparent. So in other words, when someone adjudicates an application for this visa, there will be a very simple table, a tool that you can use to just say whether someone meets the requirements, yes or no. And it ends up calculating the points for each of the criterion. And then it creates an objective outcome that can be kept as a record so that we can assess whether the visa was correctly granted or not. So, of course, it assists businesses in reducing red tape, but also very important in increasing transparency and battling fraud and corruption in this space.
How difficult has it been, or will it be, to take corruption out of the adjudication mix?
Well, I believe fundamentally that it is through automation that we will be able to do that. I think it's impossible if you continue to use a paper-based manual system that relies on people and that doesn't properly record the motivations or how the adjudication was done in some cases. I don't think you can root it out that way, but you most certainly can through automation and through the use of technology. So the points-based system is one very basic tool that will help us do that. But more than that, it will also be possible if we fully embrace the opportunities of automation, because you know, if you look at what you submit as part of applications for a visa, you know, you'll submit standard documents, and machine learning can be able to pick up a fraudulent document much more accurately than people ever could, just as one example. So that is the space that we're moving into. The points-based visa is a start in that process, but it most certainly is not the end. We've got much more to do.
As far as the technological infrastructure is concerned, are you satisfied that you have the backbone, given the less than stellar reputation that Home Affairs has had in the past?
Well, you know, Jeremy, one of the massive problems we face is the fact that we're reliant on CETA, the State Information Technology Agency. So people see Home Affairs and they get upset with Home Affairs when the system is offline, but often it's us waiting for someone else to help us. And so we are busy preparing a very comprehensive strategy that will deal with technology and the constraints we face in order to unlock the possibilities of digital transformation. Because you're absolutely right, it's no use having a good plan for how to take Home Affairs into the 21st century, but then we're roadblocked at every turn. So we are busy working on a plan for how we can overcome that. But then I think most importantly, of course, is if we're able to roll out our vision of providing Home Affairs at home, basically the idea that you can apply from anywhere with an internet connection and get documents and outcomes delivered to you digitally and to your doorstep, then of course we also circumvent the system constraints that physical Home Affairs infrastructure faces, because you'll be using your own internet connection to interact with us.
Do you believe, in respect of what you've just told me, Minister, that your current budget is sufficient to tackle all the difficulties, or are you going to require additional funding from Treasury, given that we are approaching the mini-budget?
Yes, look, our Home Affairs has been systematically underfunded over many years, so there is just simply no doubt that this department, the time has really come to take Home Affairs more seriously, and that is for both economic reasons but also for national security reasons. So there's no doubt that we're making a very strong case with Treasury for additional funding. But I think part of what we're saying is that we're not just going to go walking around with the begging bowl. We have work to do internally to maximize and reprioritize the budget that we do have. We do have an IT budget. We do have things that we can do more efficiently. And certainly, if you look at the audit outcome, for example, I mean, there's money there that we could have been using for digital transformation. And, you know, this is the state in which you find the organization. It's got a qualified audit. It's got these, you know, spending problems. It's got budget misallocation. And that's exactly the work that we're busy doing now to reallocate, reprioritize. And I do believe if we can liberate some of our own resources internally and use that more efficiently, and if we can get Treasury and the government as a whole to come to the party and say this is an important intervention, that we can find the resources to make this happen.
Minister, you are beyond 100 days now. Are there officials within your department that are hindering progress, or have you found most of them to be supportive of the reforms that you're trying to implement?
I think that there are a lot of people in Home Affairs that are encouraged and excited about this new vision. I think there are a lot of good people who tried for many years to do their best under really horrific circumstances. I mean, I always use the example of putting yourself in someone's shoes behind a service desk, and then you get a client who's been standing in the sun for 6 hours, and then you're the one who tells them the system is offline. I mean, it's not like the department and the way the model it uses has made things easy for staff either, and we must be honest about that. So my commitment to officials has been, let's re-engineer the model itself. Let's look beyond the constraints of the environment that we currently face, with only 40% of the staff required on the model that's built all around bringing people into our offices. Let's rejig the model and say, how do we take our offices out? Mm. How do we make it possible for standard services to be rendered in a way that doesn't overburden our staff? And I think that there's been a welcoming of that message, broadly speaking, in the department. I think that there's an excitement in the air as it relates to Home Affairs. And we must now capitalize on that and really bring all ideas to the table. Of course, there will always be people who have other agendas, who are perhaps engaged in nefarious activities, who are threatened by this. But I think at the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of people in South Africa want things to get better. And I think we've outlined a pathway through which Home Affairs can get better. And that is the message that I think people are taking forward.
Leon Schreiber is the Home Affairs Minister. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
In line with industry expectations that debt repayment would be a key reason for requesting two-pot withdrawals, one of the two main reasons that claimants are giving for needing the extra cash is to settle long-term debt, and the other is to cover home or car expenses. All of this is according to the Discovery Corporate and Employee Benefits Pension and Provident Fund business. They represent about 3,000 employer groups and just over 1 million employees, and ask claimants for reasons they had chosen to withdraw from their accumulated retirement savings as part of the system. More now from Guy Channels, who's Chief Commercial Officer at Discovery Corporate. Guy, very warm welcome. So how is all of this then playing out?
Thanks, Jeremy. I think what we certainly saw is that there was a buildup of people anxiously waiting at the gates. And we saw that across providers, on the first day they opened up, big flood of applications. So there's certainly a cohort of South Africans who, you know, I don't think you do that if you're just looking to get some money for, you know, bits and bobs. You do that because you're in real financial trouble. You need that money urgently. We saw that as well. We saw on the first day we opened up, we saw, to put it in context, a nice way to put it in context, is it was 180 times the volume of usual daily claims that we see. So just a massive flood of people looking. But it's also useful to put in context that notwithstanding that and the kind of ongoing relatively high claiming rates for the rest of September, the claims for September have been only about 22% of people who could have claimed. So there's still a big chunk of people who have not taken that money. And so the fear that everyone will just take everything without any restraint hasn't borne out, which is a relief to see.
Do you think people are just being a little bit more cautious, a little more judicious, or do you think that they've seen the flood and maybe taken note of the warnings that have been sounded by institutions such as yours?
I think it is the smart thing to do to not take your money if you don't need it. Some people have received kind of mixed messages or have interpreted the information they've received incorrectly and think that there's some kind of use it or lose it thing around Tupot, which of course there isn't. Mm. If you leave your money, it's your money. And the longer you leave it, the more you'll have if you ever are in a situation where you desperately need money, where it's a real emergency. So there's certainly no advantage to taking money you really don't need it. So I do think a number of people have got that message. I think another message that was put out very strongly in the month leading up to September was the one around tax. So a lot of people hadn't realized that, gosh, there's a big tax penalty to taking this money. It's taxed as income tax. And so if you take that money, it doesn't all come to you. A big chunk goes to SARS. Nobody likes SARS. So I think that also brought some restraint to people.
Having looked at the data now, is there anything that has surprised you about the primary reasons that claimants have given for withdrawal?
Jeremy, it's been really interesting to see that people seem to mostly be taking money for things that are a consequence of having been under major financial pressure for a long period of time. Rising interest rates, cost of living crisis that people have been under. It's been, in many senses, a slow burn crisis. And so what you see people spending money on now, taking money for, is home and car expenses, those kinds of regular expenses that they've struggled to keep up with. Education, paying for children's school fees that they've got behind on, and short-term debt. Those are the three big ones. And then we also see, though, a big chunk of people saying that they're taking money for home renovations, which of course is not by no stretch of imagination a real emergency, but does also reflect the fact that people haven't been able to make space in their monthly budgets for the things that they would want to spend money on, which could be kind of maintenance or improvements in their home. So it is understandable that it wouldn't strictly be advisable.
And Guy, are you able, again, mining the data that you've got, able to share any information about demographic and income trends of people who are taking advantage of this?
Yeah, Jeremy, what one might expect is that there would be a difference by income. We didn't expect to see such a great difference. We see in our kind of lowest income band, those earning less than 125,000 Rand a year, withdrawal rates of those who are eligible, that's an important caveat, is about 38%, close to 40%. Of people taking there. In our highest income band, those earning over a million, it's 4% or less. So 10 times higher in the lowest income. And it kind of slides in between those 2 points. So you do see the withdrawal rate decreasing as income increases. But why I say it's important to get that caveat is that of those in the lowest income bracket, only a third were able to take money because they had enough in their savings pot. Another two-thirds have not yet had a chance to take money because they haven't built up enough in that two-pot savings account. And so presumably we'll see kind of long tail of people taking money through the rest of the year and into next year because that highest propensity income group is yet to have a chance to take some money out.
Do you think we might see that long tail, though, wagging a little earlier, given that we're coming towards the end of the year now, high spending times such as Black Friday and Christmas?
Yes. Gosh, I'm going to be really depressed if we see a big spike around Black Friday. That's really absolutely not the right reason to take money. But what I do expect is that you'll see some people in December needing money. They're often, you kind of have a match with your income. You know, a lot of employers pay a 13th check. The big one I'm expecting, which also coincides with roughly the end of your tax year, is that back to school thing where people face real financial crunch after the Christmas spending spree and need to get kids into uniforms, etc., back to school. And I'm expecting to see a bit of a spike just then before the start of the next tax year when they'll have another chance to take money from anything that's left.
And on balance, do you think the industry per se has done enough to make sure that claimants are fully informed about the long-term impact of assessing the or accessing these savings?
Jeremy, I'd say that the industry's done a good job, worked very hard on communication and put out things that are helpful. So Discovery Led was the first to do it, but I've seen a number of other calculators come out that show you the impact. You know, who wants money? Me, please. Who wants money if it's going to have so-and-so impact? Well, now it's a trade-off, you know. So that's been the job to be done. I think it's been done fairly well. What hasn't been done well enough, I think, is the kind of just-in-time education. So We've certainly built the way that you take money in such a way that it tells you what the impact is before you finally make your decision. So, okay, you're thinking of taking this amount of money. This is what it'll do to your retirement future. This is what you'll be giving up in tax, etc. And I think those are very helpful. And I think just given the speed at which the industry had to gear up for this, not everything could be done. And I think the tide will rise. Everyone will get up to a base level of a really guarded way of taking someone through that decision-making process as they're considering it.
Well, thank you very much for the assessment so far. Guy Channel's Chief Commercial Officer at Discovery Corporate and Employee Benefits. I do appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, we've all seen these small yellow ride-hail vehicles on the road, and for many of us, they really are a menace. There have been reports of bad driving, accidents, and poor maintenance. Joining us now to discuss this is Simo Kaladic, who's Bolt's Senior Operations Manager. A very warm welcome to you, and do we have problems here?
Yes, Jeremy, we are. If you're looking at safety from a Bolt perspective, it is something that we hold really dear to our heart. We do take rider and driver safety very seriously and have implemented several measures over this past year that helps both driver and rider stay safe when they are online on the Bolt platform.
I'm wondering to what extent you have received complaints, though, and the reason why I'm asking this and the reason why we contacted you, I have seen two accidents on my way to work involving yellow vehicles and at least three incidents of bad driving. Again, let me ask you, are you satisfied that your drivers are properly trained?
That's a good question, Jeremy. So, look, in the event of an accident happening on the platform, it's very important that parties notify both the police and paramedics if it is needed. This can also be done through our SOS button in the app. Why it is important to let us know is because we've also got cover in place of any accidents happening on the platform. This is called our Bolt Trip Protection. It can cover anything from medical expenses, hospital stays, trauma counseling, as well as virtual doctor teleservices. Now, when it comes to the quality of driving behavior on the Bolt system, firstly, drivers are required to provide us with a PDP, or known as a professional driving permit, before they are actually uploaded onto the Bolt platform. This is issued by the local traffic authorities and is a hard requirement before being uploaded onto the platform. And as we understand, for a driver to obtain a PDP, they are subject to a police clearance certificate from the South African Police Services, as well as a medical certificate deeming them fit and proper to be able to operate and drive on a public road. We do keep track of driver behavior, driver quality, through different feedback mechanisms, through our algorithms on the app, as well as through client feedback. And when drivers are constantly being complained against for any quality or behavior aspects, thresholds are triggered on our app and drivers will be subject to some form of retraining, which speaks to many of the issues that they are being identified to, we could say, dropping the ball on. And drivers will be required to complete this training session before they're actually allowed back online and start completing trips again.
How often do you have to retrain drivers?
So it really just depends on the thresholds. So driver quality is actively monitored. And as soon as they hit that minimum threshold, immediately that retraining is triggered. So it's all dependent on how a driver actually behaves on the platform.
Do you need perhaps to revisit your recruitment process, given that you've had scores of drivers who've been blocked for non-compliance and safety concerns? Again, the optics would suggest a broader systemic issue within that process.
It's a good question, Jeremy. So we always take the constructive feedback back to our teams and plan and on different ways in terms of how we can actually improve the onboarding journey of a Bolt driver. Yes, we understand that many of the tips, the tricks, the training methods that we do have in place do need to constantly be updated. And this works hand in hand with the different feedback that we receive both from a driver and a rider level, as well as all the things that we do track happening within the industry itself. We constantly visit our training materials, as well as the type of initiatives that we do host to further speak to the greater issue of safety, not only on the platform, but in the country as a whole.
Are you able to tell me what percentage of your drivers, particularly in the small yellow vehicles, have been involved in traffic violations or accidents?
Well, I don't have any of that numbers at this stage, Jeremy, but can always come back to you with that if we do have an opportunity to speak again.
Would you be concerned that there is an increase, though?
While looking at our data, we haven't seen any significant increase, as this is a new project and we are critically monitoring this on a day-to-day basis to ensure that it's full success and further rollout countrywide.
And what about the physical safety of the vehicles themselves? They are small and often driving on roads where the behavior of other drivers is nothing necessarily to be proud of.
So these vehicles have passed the necessary checks when it comes to maintaining the vehicle sustainability and safety. Do believe that these vehicles have also gone through the necessary roadworthy tests and have passed and do have the required documentation to actually be operating on South African roads.
Give me a sense of the type of driver that you are recruiting in this particular space, again, as far as the yellow vehicles are concerned.
So, Jeremy, this is a new vehicle type being offered to the driver base. Essentially, it is made available for drivers who are looking for something new, who maybe not are able to afford much of the more normal larger vehicles that we see, such as hatchbacks or sedans. So the price point is quite attractive for driver partners, as we do understand that unemployment is a huge issue, as well as affordability and having actual access to the things that can help or at least equip driver partners to be able to operate on platforms like Bolt. So it's really essentially a product made available for those drivers who can't necessarily afford a bigger vehicle. They can come through, test the vehicle, test the industry, and if this is something that they want to continue pursuing, can continue with the yellow vehicle product to a point where they can now start to afford many of the larger vehicles and actually change the product offering they're willing to continue on the Bolt platform.
And just one more, are you absolutely convinced that the mechanical maintenance of these vehicles is up to scratch?
Yes, Jeremy. So again, these vehicles have gone through thorough testing, both on a quality and mechanical level, just to ensure that both the driver and passengers will actually be comfortable and safe when they do use this product on the Bolt platform.
All right, Simo Kaladic, thank you very much for talking to me today. And just before I say goodbye to you, on our last online poll, we referred to the Steinhoff and Ben Lakranji five-year prison term. I asked if the five-year prison term fits the crime or got off lightly, and most of our respondents do think it is the latter. And today, relating to an earlier interview that I did with the new Home Affairs Minister, Leon Schreiber, all about fixing the department, fixing the ministry, and my question to you today, it's either starting to work or lots of work still to do. We're not even close to any resolution yet. If you have a view on that, please share it with the MoneyWeb at Midday community. You can participate either on X or on LinkedIn. And that's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.